This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 23rd of November 2014 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly is brought to you in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to edition 281 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, forget Freud and Jung, we put psychoanalyst Sabrina Spielrein in the spotlight as we meet the author of a new book about her work and thoughts.
Plus, we meet one of the men behind a unique archive of Russian criminal tattoos, and prize-winning photographer Abby Traylor-Smith gives us a snapshot of her work.
That's all coming up on the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
On we go, Andrew, like a human icebreaker through the Northwest Passage of the year of words of copy of is it?
We could have got iced in a few moments. I think over the past week.
Yeah, exactly. I like my ice sort of really at the bottom of a glass, rather than on such a grand and epic scale.
We just finished what's kind of a brand new magazine for us. It's called The Forecast. On newsstands from the beginning of December, it's our kind of look ahead at 2015, 2016, 2017. It's kind of us casting our eyes ahead, what the world will look like and everything from your domain, culture, through to kind of geopolitics.
You call it a forecast. It's felt like more of a five-cast. Putting it together. But it's been one bigger than you thought, right? Yes. It's a big boy. I think he's going to surprise our regular buyers, our regular readers, not because he's a handsome piece of kit, but he's a little bit changed up, isn't he? He's kind of Monocle DNA. But he's a sort of the handsome child.
Yes.
I don't want to. Let's not use any. I've got into trouble for some of my analogies on this program.
I think I won't. We'll stop there with the analogies now. But you're kind of heading off now, aren't you?
Off I go. Later today, I'm getting on a plane. I'm going to Miami. I'm getting married. So no biggie.
And then you're going to go. And then you're going to go to the art fair.
And then I'm going to the art fair. And then I'm going to meet up with you and Tyler in Asia.
Yes.
So it's going to be rocking.
We have quite a few things.
There's going to be a few stamps on my passport. Yeah, exactly. I've started basically using my passport as a notebook anyway, so it's good. There aren't really many pages left.
Yeah, but don't start. Didn't I have a wife at the beginning of this trip?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be one of those trips where you sort of start off where you get married. Let's not tempt fate. Andrew.
Okay, good.
Well,
I think we should call in the man himself.
The man with a new jingle. It is the one and only Tom Edwards.
From Monocle's editorial floor comes the world's hardest-hitting journalist.
Like a cuddly newsman. That's the effect I'm looking for.
He has uncompromising standards.
That's right, I'm setting the bar that low.
And is never afraid to expose new ideas. It's Tom Edwards with the news look ahead.
Sometimes you've got to stick with what you know.
Well, you don't know much.
Nice.
I'm sort of freshly insulted by that.
I forgot how good that was.
It's quite damning, isn't it? Because I always like to think this sort of takes the form of good-natured badinage, but actually that's quite hurtful.
It's a bit like...
It's
having your yearly review in front of the listening several.
Yeah, never mind.
Anyway, what's going to happen next week, Tom?
Some new ideas.
I've actually got hard-hitting news for you this week. I thought, because of this pressure, because of the constant workplace bullying that I'm subjected to, that I'd go for some serious news. We've got sort of environmental things, politics, all this sort of thing.
Okay.
So we'll start off with this one. This is a bit of environment. We've got big business involved. The Canary Islands are today undertaking a referendum. And this is all about drilling for oil and gas. It's kind of flavour of the month around the world, you know, trying to become energy independent, this sort of thing. And the Spanish government has upset a lot of people on the island because Repsol, one of the big sort of oil companies, has been given permission to explore near the Canary Islands archipelago. That's right.
Good word.
And that people aren't that happy about it. So they're going to ask this question. Do you think the Canaries should change its environmental and tourism model for the sake of oil and gas exploration? So it's the classic thing. Do you chase the black gold or do you stick with the tourist dollar? And the country is very much at odds. So it'll be interesting to see which way
this
shapes up.
Sort of from Tenerife to Tenerife.
Man, alive.
That's pretty good.
That's not bad.
Someone's had a good night's sleep last night. And it was fresh to daisy.
It's been an impressive punning form this week. There's been a few. There was one earlier in the week. I can't remember it. I was going to say it stuck with me, but clearly
No, it was. You were asked if someone was... you were trying to get someone's attention because they were going to go off and do a report about avalanches.
Avalanches,
And when they didn't kind of respond to you, I said, I'm sorry, they're a bit snowed under.
classic.
That's very good.
That is good.
That's pretty good.
I see that's freshly. That's freshly impressive.
I'm a comedy machine.
And it's interesting.
You're having a lunch.
I've got other sort of oil news. So it's topical. It's hard hitting. There's an OPEC meeting in Vienna on Thursday. Now this is interesting on a number of levels. Obviously, oil prices have been tumbling. I'm sure you guys have been following.
How many levels is it interesting in? On
a number.
A number of levels. I'd say five.
Wow.
Okay.
I'll go through them one by one in a moment. Okay. And obviously, this is good news for a number of people. It's good news for the end consumer in some countries. It's good news for emerging markets who are very energy hungry. But it's bad news for producers, and it can have quite a destabilizing effect. And so everyone is looking to Vienna later this week on Thursday to see whether or not those OPEC countries will cut production. That's obviously the way they can protect and try and boost the prices. A lot of people suggest if they do that, it'll be very damaging in the longer term because, you know, the business can go elsewhere. You've got the US, for example, who now produce a lot of their own oil.
But Mr. Putin, for example, is a bit nervous about it.
He'll be edgy. And there's a couple of countries, Russia very much, Venezuela again, where, you know, it's very important what happens at this meeting on Thursday. So keep an eye.
On Oh Vienna.
Oh Vienna. Oil Vienna.
Okay.
More Middle Eastern news. That's right. So tomorrow, the deadline for world powers and Iran to agree on this deal about Iran's nuclear program. Will they meet the deadline?
Probably not. They are allowed an extension, I believe.
They can negotiate small extensions, but it's always interesting to look at the rhetoric on these big deadline days. I know Rob always looks to see, you know, what are people saying?
Well, I've got my rhetoric spotter out. It's an app, isn't it? You get it on the iPhone.
Very popular.
On the iPhones.
And then another hard-hitting story. Towards the end of this week, by Saturday, we'll get the verdict in the latest trial of Hosni Mubarak, of course, the former Egyptian president who was charged with killing protesters back in 2011. He's given a heavy sentence. He appealed. The appeal court upheld that, so it's gone. They ordered a retrial. He's been under house arrest, and we should get a verdict by next week. And that'll be interesting to, again, observe not just what happens to him personally, but, of course, the knock-on effect on people looking on still in Cairo. Where people
and I wonder if he'll still go to court in his bed.
He might do. I admire
that's quite
that.
A good look, yeah.
I'm going to actually try and introduce that for my news gathering duties.
I'm going to start broadcasting from my bed.
Wheeled in. Four poster.
Not in that
brought
way.
Onto the editorial floor.
Yeah, that's the way.
Is there more?
I've got one other one. This is a
is it about
local
cheese
story.
Rolling now?
It's more sort
like
of
that.
British.
Yeah.
But and it's got a cultural hat. It's that one
cheese
of my favourite.
Quite British.
No, that's what I'm saying. So we're going British, but we're not going as sort of esoteric
British.
As cheese rolling. One of my favourite book awards of the year is the William Hill Sports Book of the Year Award, celebrating the best in sporting writing, Andrew.
Last year was that wonderful horse racing book.
That's right, Doped. Jamie Reid's book. Yeah. A huge doping scandal in this sort of history of defined British horse racing. And there's been some amazing books, some left field choices, some more celebrated. There's some big hitters in there, literally, metaphorically. Mike Tyson, the...
A book about, or he's written a book?
I think, I'm assuming it's about him.
Yes,
that could be wrong. I don't want to get on his wrong side.
Can you imagine his big hands on a keyboard? He'd be hitting the wrong letter all the time.
Hand.
Oh, no!
Yeah, like one of those typewriters like for like a telephone for old people with very big numbers.
The huge keys. But others, we've got Olympic gold medalists writing books. Gareth Thomas, the rugby union player who came out while he was still playing rugby as gay. And it was a huge sort of, you know, watershed, a real landmark. And his book's got, you know, incredible press. So he's up for the award as well. And it's always one of my favourites.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I love the great sporting journalism.
We should get the winner in. That'd be a good pre-Christmas thing. They'd love it. We'd love it.
Everyone's a winner.
Everyone's a winner.
Nice fantasy sports writing. David Sedaris. Yeah. He wrote a very funny story about imagining that he was Mike Tyson's boyfriend.
That I'm going to go and read right now.
It is. It's very funny.
Well,
it's
like he's properly aroused.
Don't stop. Stop.
I'm not gonna
back in your corner. Back in your corner. Cold towels.
Talk about ear nibbling.
Okay.
Oh, of course. So many grades of ear nibbling. That
there are many grades of it.
From sort of endearing to the frankly terrifying.
Downright terrifying, exactly.
Well, Mr. Edwards.
I'm being censored by my co-host. It's great. It's really nice.
It's for your own safety.
He's going to come back a married man when we see him next time.
God, that's exciting, isn't it, Rob?
It is exciting, yeah. It's good. Talking of ear nibbling.
Mike's looking forward
leave
to
it. There. Tom, thank you very much.
Pleasure
well,
as
I'll
always.
See you. I'll see you in a few weeks.
I'll see you in a few weeks. Have a lovely time, Rob.
Thank you very much.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Fuel, the designers and publishers have produced an abundance of well-crafted books on quirky and compelling subjects, but they're best known perhaps for their books on Russian criminal tattoos, for which they found an archive back in 2009.
Depicted through photography and line drawings, the tattoos are not just fascinating to look at, studied carefully, their coded meanings illuminate life under lock and key in Russia. Damon Murray from Fuel joins us in the studio now. Damon, tell us about the archive, first of all. It's a huge number of pictures, I understand, you have access to. How did you get a hold of it?
We were shown them by a friend in Russia, and we knew that they needed to be, you know, we really liked the look of them, and we knew they had to be seen by a wider audience.
Now, before we start diving into the book, obviously tattoos are a big story at the moment. Every hipster seems to have a tattoo, but this is a kind of a different world of tattoos, isn't it? Could you just explain to us the kind of imagery that we're going to be talking about?
Well, it ranges from religious through to erotic through to swastikas. It's loads of different symbols there, but the meanings are all kind of twisted, and they act as a CV for the criminal, as it were. So you can tell the criminal's position within the prison and criminal society by the tattoos that he's wearing.
Is that something you can do now? Can you decode these pictures, Damon? I mean, you can flick through it and give us maybe an example.
Yeah, to an extent, yeah. We can.
It's kind of like looking at the hallmarks on the bottom of a piece of antique furniture or something, right? Hello and welcome to the Antiques Roadshow with me, Damon Murray. Today we're going to be doing Russian criminals. Right?
But what I like, Damon, is that people are quite literate. If they're a murderer, it's not that they try and cover up the fact they have a tattoo that reveals their crime often.
Yeah, I mean, generally murderers are depicted by a skull with a dagger through a skull, or there might be a dagger which runs across the neck and out the other side, across the shoulder and out the other side of the neck. That means that they've been a murderer and they're available to commit other murders inside prison.
And we should introduce this gentleman, Arkady Bronikov. He's the guy who was travelling around Russia, taking these pictures, building up the archive originally?
Yeah, he was a police officer and he recognised that the tattoos were a kind of coded language, that if he was able to decipher that coded language, he may be able to solve crimes and help track down criminals.
And is this a Russian phenomenon? I mean, it's famous, you know. It's only recently, I guess, in the last 5-10 years, become part of films, Eastern Promises and things. But is it a purely Russian phenomenon? And I wonder why, if it is.
I think this type is purely a Russian phenomenon. I mean, there are plenty of other prison tattoos.
Yeah.
That, you know, we're all kind of familiar with the American ones, South African ones as well. But I think this particular type and this particular language was a moment in time, as it were, which is generally the Soviet period.
Because there's an interesting thing where there was no iconography under communism. You had one picture in your house, which was maybe of Lenin, if not, it was of Stalin. But then underneath people's clothes, they had these amazing pieces of art. It's a funny thing, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the criminals themselves even tattooed images of the leaders, you know,
right.
Stalin and Lenin on
just
their
in
body.
Case.
Well, that was, it was just in case because, you know, the story goes that the authorities, the guards, weren't allowed to shoot images of the leaders.
All right.
So that was, in a sense, protecting them. In the same way, they often had pictures of Lenin and the word Vor underneath, which is an acronym which stands for Leader of the Bolshevik Revolution. But Vor also stands for thief. And so there's this kind of double play that goes on with these images, and they're constantly kind of changing and evolving. The criminals themselves saw the leaders as leaders and criminals of the big zone, which was Russia, and then they themselves were the leaders and criminals of the smaller zone, which was the prisons and the gulags.
The decoding of it, so we should point out a couple, there's a gentleman here who has got a church on his chest, and you think, oh, this might be nice, he might be religious. It turns out that this shows his devotion to the world of thieves and customs. And there's another one here where there's a priest being buggered by another gentleman, and it says that these were done when people had lost at cards. They would be forced to have these done to them, and then they had to pay the tattooists themselves. That's quite in-depth knowledge. How did you begin to decode these? Did someone in Russia come to you and say, with not only the pictures, but with a bit of knowledge so you could begin to interpret them?
Well, Bronnikov himself, you know, spoke firsthand to these criminals. He was photographing them. He worked as a teacher later on in a criminalistic school, and his students also photographed and recorded the stories that the criminals told. So this is all first-hand knowledge. And then you have people like Danzig Buldeyev, who did all the drawings. He was a prison guard for his whole career, and he also travelled the length of the Gulag system, making these drawings and speaking to people firsthand.
So I think you have a number in here that some 35 million people were in jail at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty, it's kind of unimaginable. It's very difficult to understand what that means. You know, it's pretty much, if your family, you know, a number of people in your immediate family would have been through the system at some time or another. It's hard to comprehend.
Who are the tattoo artists, Damon?
The tattoo artists are people who obviously have an artistic bent. They've
wound up prisoners, were they?
Yeah, they've wound up in prison. Yeah. And actually, they're very well respected because as a tattooist in prison, you have to have a knowledge of what you're doing and the meanings and symbols of all the tattoos you're making. So
you wield a certain amount of power, presumably, if you're the guy with the, well, guy with the ink, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're very well respected. And certain tattooists, like for instance, tattooists in the Ural prisons of the Urals, were renowned for their craftsmanship. And thieves would often try and get themselves transferred to the Urals so that they could get their tattoos done. And then they used adapted razors and a sharpened guitar string. That was the standard method of tattooing in prisons, and still is today because it's forbidden by the authorities.
Yeah. And is there a sort of pecking order in terms of the, we talked about the sort of biographical implications of the designs of the art on people's bodies, but is there a pecking order in terms of maybe the delicacy of the designs, you know, in terms of maybe we can make it something that it's the opposite of, but almost like the army, how many stripes you've got on your arm? Was there something like that going on as well?
Basically, the kind of thieves in law were the top criminals. They had stars tattooed on their clavicles. That's the kind of standard thing. And then they were also tattooed, for instance, with the suit of clubs and the suit of spades from card games. They're the kind of honourable suits. And then the other end of that scale, the suit of hearts, meant that you were a downcast, and that was forcibly applied. So that those sort of tattoos would mean you're the bottom of the rung. You'd be ostracised by the criminal fraternity, and they weren't allowed to talk to you or even touch you because that would mean that they would themselves be lowered. And these people would have their own separate area to eat.
It's a really ancient caste system, isn't it?
Totally, totally.
Yeah.
They'd have to eat from their own cutlery that would be drilled with holes so that it was all recognised.
Wow.
It's
fascinating.
It's incredible separate world that we just don't know anything about.
And tell us what happens. So you've got so many images, future books to come out. You've already done some books prior to this. What do you want to happen with that archive?
We've got another book that is sort of in production, which will probably come out in a year or so's time, which is the second volume of the Police Files. And then we've been exhibiting the archive. We've done a few exhibitions in London. We've done one in Berlin. And I think for us, the ultimate destination for the archive would be a decent museum show because there's so much material there now. It's kind of reached that stage where that's the way to do it justice.
Just finally, you mentioned that a lot of the tattoos up to presumably to the 80s riffed on the Soviet era and paid homage to it or kind of stuck out its tongue at it. What about post-Soviet? Do people have, are there Putin tattoos? Do people have one just in case?
The thing about the tattoos from this kind of period, I mean, tattooing is still prevalent within the system, obviously. It's a kind of a mark of honour still, you know. There's still kind of some weight behind it, but it's nowhere near as strong as it used to be. I mean, there was a time when if you had the wrong tattoo and your tattoo didn't match your crimes, and you were found out, you were given a brick or a piece of glass and told to remove the tattoo. And if you didn't remove the tattoo, you paid the consequences, which could be fatal, you know. But now, particularly in the sort of late 80s, drugs came into the prisons quite a lot, and that kind of blew the kind of old system away. And so anyone could buy any tattoo that they wanted using drugs as currency, and that kind of undid the strict rules of the old system of tattooing.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating stuff, isn't it, Andrew? It's amazing. An amazing book. It's beautifully laid out. And there is a section at the front, we should say as well, which kind of gives you a reader's primer, doesn't it, with designs and different parts of the body and all the rest of it. It's brilliant stuff. Damon Murray from Fuel, thank you very much for joining us. And that book is Russian Criminal Tattoo Police Files. And it's available exclusively from the Fuel website, fuel-design.com, along with all their other great books. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
All right, you're tuned into the Monocle Weekly with me, Rob Bound, and Andrew Tuck. Next up, we're talking about a psychoanalyst who had a thing or two to say about our drive to destruction. So here's Ladytron with Destroy Everything You Touch. That was Destroy Everything You Touch by Ladytron.
Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service. Based in the heart of London with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries, we broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion, but the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks, and they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kinds of games. The games that uses the city, and the other kind is the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our Timeshift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone, and hear it all on iTunes.
I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
I remember saying, deliver beer in New York City, I can hardly afford my car insurance, so I'm going to insure a truck.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Ask a person to name a famous psychoanalyst, and the guessing is that they'll probably name Sigmund Freud, perhaps Carl Jung. Less likely, perhaps, is that the name Sabina Spielrein will crop up. Yet Spielrein, one of the very first female psychoanalysts, is arguably one of the most significant figures in sexual psychology.
If you've seen the film A Dangerous Method, you may well feel familiar with the thinker already, but a new book places her in a whole new light. That book is Sex versus Survival by the doctor, therapist and medical educator John Lorna. John joins us in the studio now. John, first of all, explain to us who she is.
She was, as you say, one of the very first women psychoanalysts. In the course of her career, she wrote something like 37 papers, nearly all of them very innovative, describing new techniques, describing new approaches to the mind. Tragically, she was murdered in the Holocaust in 1942, and after her death, she became virtually forgotten.
And why was she forgotten? Because she wasn't around to continue her work, because she was a woman and people kind of ignored her work. Why do you think that she, you know, because you say she has, you know, many ideas which feel like 100 years ahead of their time.
Yes.
Why do you feel that she did get forgotten?
I think you've mentioned two of the reasons. One was her death in the Holocaust and the other that she was a woman. But I think there were two other important factors. One is that she had a very strong belief in the importance of biology and evolution in particular, which was very much against the culture and the climate of psychoanalysis at the time. And the other is she was very much a bridge builder. She had a fierce opposition to the idea that psychologists, psychiatrists, analysts should form camps, that they should be gurus, that they should fight with each other for the supremacy of their ideas. She had a very strong belief that psychology, like any other science, should depend on collaboration and mutual respect. That wasn't a popular line to take when all the different Freudian, Jungian and other schools were trying to distance themselves from each other.
Was the fact that Sabina was obviously a woman, did that make the sex thing difficult for people to digest? They'd take it from Freud or from Jung, from a man, but maybe it was tougher to take the truth or a version of it from a woman on this touchy subject.
I think that's absolutely right, because she took a view of sex not only that was a woman's view, but also a view that was based on her own experience of physical and probably sexual abuse within the family, of having been seduced by her psychiatrist, of having had the two leading men of psychoanalysis conspire to try and silence and then marginalised her. This wasn't a very popular position to be arguing about sex from, but what she did say was actually entirely consistent with Darwin's theory of evolution, and a lot of her ideas about sex have become more or less the consensus nowadays, particularly in the worlds of biology and evolution.
And what were those ideas about sex? Explain to our listeners, you know, why her thinking was so fresh.
The title itself, Sex versus Survival, actually acknowledges the fact that she thought that people had a real struggle in their lives between decisions to do with having relationships, having children, and looking after themselves, that particularly for women, there was an enormous struggle between the natural, instinctive desire to reproduce, to procreate, to have descendants, but also the tremendous risks that went with that. I mean, the risks of abandonment, the risks of being abused in a relationship, the risks indeed of losing one's career because of the necessity of looking after children in a world where most men weren't willing to and perhaps still aren't. All these were very much women's themes, one could say feminist themes, and you can understand why they weren't terribly popular among the male leaders of her profession.
It's an interesting intellectual battleground, isn't it? Because you have these three great thinkers, two of which are acknowledged or have been previously acknowledged as such, and one that's only just coming to light now, perhaps. Do they act in this sort of these three wheels? Do they act in this strange Venn diagram like their beliefs do, like their studies show us that they might? Does, for example, Sabina Spielrein's beliefs bear themselves out in her behaviour with Freud and Jung?
Yes, in a number of ways. I mean, firstly, she forgave both of them, even though Jung had seduced her and even though Freud had joined in a conspiracy to silence her. She forgave them, which wasn't something that went on very much in those circles at the time. As you no doubt know, Freud and Jung, after a very close friendship for 6 or 7 years, then had a bitter enmity for the rest of their lives. And Jung's name could not be mentioned in the Freud household, for example. But she was also so opposed to the way that they worked, in that they were very certain about their ideas. They were dogmatic. They each produced a worldview that they said, this is how it is. Whereas her writing is very tentative. She's saying, well, it might be like that and it might be like this, and shouldn't we take that into account? And at one point in 1917, she wrote an extraordinary letter to Jung where she said, your ideas and Freud's Edwards and Adlers, who was the other great leader at the time, they can really all be harmonized. They can all be brought together. If you think of them within a biological framework, within an evolutionary framework, they all make sense in different ways. Now, no one was thinking like that, and everybody was saying, I'm right, or you're wrong, or there was no understanding of the idea that maybe everybody had a little to contribute.
Maybe, not wanting to be exceptionally simplistic about it, but there's an element of her femininity in that inclusive attitude, perhaps, do you think?
I think that's right, and one of the things I do at the end of my book is to look at why certain women figures in that world, particularly Anna Freud and Melanie Klein, but there are other examples as well, did become very successful, very prestigious. But isn't it interesting that Anna Freud and Melanie Klein also ended up not on speaking terms with each other and founding different schools of thought within the British psychoanalytic movement? So in many ways, they played politics like the men played them. And Spielwein was almost unique in absolutely refusing to do that. And I would see that as very much a part of her behaving as a woman, not playing by the men's rules, not playing their games, even, I think, to the extent of suffering a great deal as a result, not being acknowledged, not being remembered.
John, she was murdered in the Holocaust along with her daughters.
Indeed.
Tell us how, you know, obviously many of the leading figures in the psychoanalysis movement managed to leave.
Yes.
And they had connections outside of the country. As she did, she had connections in Switzerland.
Yes.
How come her fate was as it was?
She went back to Russia originally in 1923, intending only to be an ambassador for a little while, perhaps a year or two, and then return. She got very much drawn into the emerging psychoanalytic movement and a very well-known kindergarten in Moscow, and became very committed to that. At that point, she discovered that her husband, from whom she'd been separated for many years, had actually formed another relationship and had another child. And she seems to have gone back to her hometown in southern Russia in order to restore that relationship and to be with him, and indeed to take her own daughter back. They reunited, they had another child, they stayed together until he died in the late 1930s. So by that time, she was very much re-established in Russia, working as a doctor in Russia. There is a debate about why she didn't leave when it was clear the Nazis would invade southern Russia. And it seems to be she'd lived in Switzerland and in Germany, and she had a tremendous respect for German culture. Her brothers had been killed by Stalin, and she actually believed at that point that it was the Russians who were the bigger danger, and that the Germans could not possibly commit the atrocities that they were being credited with.
And just finally, is Sabina Spielrein's work now lauded? I mean, you've written a book about her. It's a biography. It's also about her struggle with Freud and Jung, as we've talked about. Is her work practiced by psychoanalysts today? Is she now one of the canons in that set text, if you like?
Until recently, I would have said absolutely not. What's happened in the few years while I've been writing this book is that I've, in the process of research, discovered networks of people, particularly women psychiatrists, feminist psychoanalysts, who are rediscovering her in the same way that I have. And I'm now in touch with people in several countries, Scandinavia, the United States, Russia, where they are beginning to take her ideas very seriously. And my prediction would be that within 10 years, she will have a very substantial stature in 20th century intellectual history.
Well, it's a fascinating story. The book is Sex Versus Survival, The Life and Ideas of Sabina Spielrein. And the author you heard from him was John Lorner. John, thank you very much.
Up next, we meet photographer Abby Traylor-Smith.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulet and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at McGlory House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive, and it's imported from Italy.
And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his reports across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
And now, from the cerebral to the visual, self-taught and trained in law, Abby Traylor-Smith is not necessarily your conventional documentary and portrait photographer. Her assignments have seen her witness famine in Malawi, anniversaries in the Falklands and at Pearl Harbor, and the aftermath of the Asian tsunami. And she's reported on conflict in Darfur and Sudan with the veteran journalist Bill Deeds.
Earlier this year, Abby's image Shannon received a prize in the 2014 World Press Photo Contest. As part of our ongoing project, The Big O, Abby's been looking at childhood obesity in the UK. And she joins us now on the line to tell us about her work life and that winning piece. Abby, welcome to the show. And first of all, let's talk about The Big O. It's a good name for a serious-minded project, I guess. What turned you on to that originally? Is it trying to find some beauty in something that's traditionally not seen as that?
I think the idea for the title came from the big C, where the C stands for cancer as the kind of thing to fear. So the big O was supposed to be a kind of reflection on that. You know, obesity seems to be the thing to fear, but I want to sort of challenge those preconceptions, really. So that's where the title came from.
And tell us, we were talking there at the beginning that your route into the world of photography wasn't exactly a traditional one. And before we kind of look at some of the other images that you've done, just tell us a little bit about how you started off.
I was kind of self-taught, really. My parents were both into art and photography, and I picked a camera up at an early age. When it came time to go to university, they sort of talked me into the idea that if I went to study law, I could do art in my spare time, but vice versa, it wouldn't probably work out. They'd both been to art college and knew that was a difficult route. But when I got to college, I became obsessed with photography through the student newspaper. And when I graduated, I gave myself a year to get work as a professional photographer before going back to do my bar exams. And luckily for me, the Telegraph picked me up quite soon, and within a matter of months I was working for the Telegraph on a regular basis.
What's the trick? Is it finding the subject, or is it finding your sort of your voice as a photographer and the way that you shoot, or is it really finding those amazing subject matters to begin with in your career?
Do you mean when you're starting out?
Yeah, when you're starting out, is it important to have a very signature look that people can, you know, they don't even have to look at the photo byline, or they don't have to look in the gutter for the credit on a magazine page, but it's picking the subjects that you shoot. Is that the important thing, the editorial eye?
I think it's a combination of, obviously your style is important, that people can recognise your work, but I think the content's got to be there too. And you've got to be saying something. Your pictures have got to move people. So I think it's a whole combination of things that you need to kind of gun for as a young photographer. And choose subjects that you care about and you can stick with. Because when you're working on long-term projects, you've got to have that passion to keep going.
And Abby, I wanted to ask you about that commitment. I looked at some of the amazing pictures you've done about refugees, about asylum seekers, and especially those who have found themselves kind of not able to get into the system in any way. And again, you juxtapose the beautiful with the tragic. There's an amazing photograph just of a phone box in Hampstead covered in snow. And at first glance, you think it's a really beautiful image. Then you see that it's where somebody was sleeping rough, an Iranian. In a world where, you know, it's the digital, it's, you know, you upload it now and you like it and you hate it and it's done with, you're working on projects where it's kind of classic photography. You need people to back you for a while and want to support your work and want to run it on paper and hang it in galleries. Do you feel that in the world that you occupy that it's still a special place in media?
Yeah, I definitely think that's a special place to work within. It means you can produce work that you care about and that means something to you, but you can also use the social media to promote that work and do a more kind of day-to-day type of photography, which can keep you fresh. So I like working in a traditional way and using social media for different types of work. I think they both have real value. But what I love about what I call slow photography, that long-term approach, means you really get in depth with something, which I think shows in the images then at the end. And I suppose with my images, I am capturing the beauty and the tragedy at the same time. I don't want to turn people off by just showing them tragedy, because there's a lot of positivity within the lives we lead. So I hope that my work shows both those things.
Let's talk about this this image, Shannon, Abby. I mean, it's an amazing image. It's quite a well-known image. I'm sure our listeners can Google it if they're unfamiliar with it. But tell us about how close you get to your subject matter, whether you need to be friendly in order to get them to reveal themselves, kind of literally in this way, with Shannon, or whether you have to keep that kind of editorial professional distance. It's a tough one, isn't it?
It is a tough one. But with this project, The Big O, it's so personal to me that I'm not pretending to keep an editorial distance. That image of Shannon was shot, I think, I've been photographing her now for 4 years, and I don't think she would have stripped off to her underwear, you know, had I just met her. But she's known me now for 4 years, we've become friends, and the picture evolved as part of a story, because I phoned her up one day and she told me she was going to have a gastric balloon operation as part of a medical trial for children, which means that it's not kind of not invasive surgery like normal gastric band surgery. And I suggested doing a before picture, and she was totally up for it. So I felt like that image was a real collaboration, and that does come out of spending time with your subjects and getting to know them. And she came down to London to see the image on the opening night of the World Press Photo at the South Bank, and she was really proud to have her image up there. So that's what I think I've come to learn you get out of long-term work. You get something real, you know.
And what about the sort of less long-term work? Does that kind of keep you fresh for these long-term projects, the way that you can be selfish, using the word nicely, about your long-term projects, this big sort of editorial plans you have, the other stuff, the sort of meat and drink stuff as a photographer? Does that keep you fresh, keep you kind of light on your feet?
Well, for me, I mean, I just love taking pictures. I need to take pictures every day, so I use Instagram as my kind of diary. Before Instagram, I was taking pictures on a Ricoh film camera and sticking them in a scrapbook every week. So for me, photography's got lots of different exciting things about it, and for me, it's sort of part of the way I operate. I have to use photography in my life. So I think for me, it definitely keeps me fresh, and I love the juxtaposition of working on long-term projects against shorter things, because, you know, long-term projects, you come up against brick walls and dead ends, and you need something fresh to kind of keep you going and keep you fighting for your work.
Now, you worked with Bill Deeds, and we should explain for people who are listening around the world. He was well-known, at least in the UK. He was one of these journalists who kind of carried on and just carried on. He never retired and was, you know, still doing great things very late in life. How important was that relationship to you?
It was wonderful working with Bill. My first job with him was when I first started working for the paper, and I was only about 22 and he was 88, and we were sent to cover the burial of Haile Selassie in Ethiopia. And the last time Bill had been there was in 1939, when he'd been to cover the war in Abyssinia. So that was my first foreign trip for the Telegraph with Bill, and it led to a really good working relationship. And I mean, he was still working on into his 90s, and we did trips to Sudan, and he taught me a lot about journalism, and he taught me a lot about reporting. You know, he would say things to me like, the only thing that's going to get Africa to change is the education of women. And he was a very modern, contemporary man in that sense. You know, he saw things at grassroots level, and he was always interested in the everyday and the daily life. And I think that's where I've got a lot of my inspiration from Bill.
There's an interesting thing with working with such a notable writer and reporter as Bill, but also just working with any writer, it's a back and forth thing. As one of the editors of the magazine myself, I know that every time you do a story with a photographer, they're kind of asking the questions that you forgot to ask yourself, and maybe you're pointing the photographer in the direction. It's always good to sort of work in a team like that, I guess. Is that, I mean, I wonder if that's your preferred way of operating, or whether you're a bit of a lone wolf with your camera.
I do like to be a lone wolf on occasion, but I love working in a team, and especially when you click with someone like the way I did with Bill and the way I've done with lots of good writers, you know, that kind of team effort can be really exciting and take you in new directions. So I think, I mean, I hate to sit on the fence, but I think both have their value.
Okay, Abby, thank you very much for joining us. That was photographer Abby Traylor-Smith, whose work can be caught during the last couple of days of the World Press Photo of the Year 2014 show at London's South Bank Centre. Light and Shade in that edition, which was, by the way, 281 of the Monocle Weekly.
You said that rather weakly.
I did say rather weakly. Okay. I know the flesh was willing, but the spirit's willing. The flesh is weak, I think, this week slightly. Yeah, it's been a long week. It's been a big week. Boom. Yeah.
As ever, nice guess. Now, going back to the criminal tattoos thing, it's got a thing at here, how to kind of... describe a criminal, and I have to kind of... the inclination of how you stand. Oh, yes. Are you a forward leaner, or are you a verticaler, an incliner, or are you skewed? Can't quite tell. You're more skewed, I think.
Am I skewed?
Well, skewed is when you're kind of like leaning back a little bit.
What does that make me then? What am I, sort of...
I don't think it means... It's just when you're writing up your criminal report, I'd say, Mr. Bound, skewed.
I hope I'm sort of like, despite the fact I'm wearing a blue collar today, I hope I can be a white collar criminal and get sort of not go to like an open prison or
good
something.
Examples of what someone with a little mouth and a big mouth looks like.
God.
I know how big your mouth is, so that's easy.
I don't think I've been censored on today's show. I've been on best behaviour. I think after previous week's misdemeanors, it's good. You love that book, you know, you're taken by the tattoo book.
Well, I think that's strange. You, this gentleman is apparently in the book because he's got
a big old face,
narrow forehead. The fact that he's got no teeth would be the more kind of noticeable thing if I was trying to catch him.
Well, maybe not in a Russian prison. It's probably not a kind of place. They're not resorts renowned for their dentistry, presumably.
No.
Nice. Should we call it a day, Andrew?
Let's call it a
day. I've got to get on a plane. I need some sunshine. It's cold in Studio One.
You need to go and marry a fine lady.
I do indeed. Let's thank our pals behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Alice Bloch, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week with different personnel, I hasten to add. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.